Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt. In our bi-monthly podcasts, we interview philosophers about their new books across a wide variety of philosophical topics and areas. Today's interview is with Carlos Montemayor, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at San Francisco State University, about his new book, Minding Time, A Philosophical and Theoretical Approach to the Psychology of Time, from Brill. The philosophy of time has a variety of subtopics that are of great general as well as philosophical interest, such as the nature of time, the possibility of time travel, and the nature of tensed language. Montemayor focuses on the question, how do we represent time? That is, how is temporal information represented in biological creatures such as ourselves? He argues that traditional discussions of the specious present in fact confuse two sorts of representations of the present. Instead, empirical evidence points to a two-phase model, the sensorial present and the phenomenal present. The first is a non-conscious, multimodal, integrated simultaneity window that is closely tied to our biological clocks and which informs our sensory motor systems. The second is the rich conscious experience of succession or passage of time that does not obey the same metric constraints. In this richly detailed study, Montemayor blends empirical research on biological timekeeping mechanisms and psychological measures of simultaneity judgments with philosophical accounts of mental representation and consciousness. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Carlos.
Oh, hi, Carrie.
Hi. Glad to have you on New Books in Philosophy.
It's great to be here, and thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very happy.
Well, it's a very interesting book. I've been actually doing a number of books on various aspects of time, you know, temporal propositions, and this particular book in The Psychology of Time, The Representation of Time, mm-hmm. And I'd like to do others. So it's a very interesting, the whole area, philosophical area, talking about time is very interesting, and your book focuses on a particularly, you know, interesting question of how do we represent time. So let me, before we get into the actual, you know, body of the book, maybe you could give us a little bit of introductory information about yourself, how you came to philosophy and how you came to this particular topic.
Sure, definitely. So I started out getting really interested in just mental representation in general, how that happens, sort of traditional views of different ways of accounting for the content of mental representation, and then different issues. So as you well know, very quickly you get swamped into other problems like what is the phenomenal character of experience, what is the relationship between that and mental representations, and what is the relationship between mental representations and just representations in general, like scientific representations, and so on. So I was always interested in that. I mean, I, I, uh, was also interested in other issues before I started doing philosophy. Like I studied law, and I was interested in the problem of value and human rights and so on. But nothing really interested me as much as this issue of what is a representation, and particularly a mental representation. And of course, it's a very old problem and a very traditional problem in philosophy to account for what exactly and what precisely happens when we grasp a proposition or we represent the world in a certain way. And then I realized that the space and time representation were incredibly fascinating to me. And I was lucky enough to be close to people who worked on these areas in psychology, people that did experiments on, or that still do experiments in perceptual visual attention and sort of mechanisms for timekeeping. And so I was very interested in trying to understand the philosophical aspects of what they were doing and sort of isolate, because as you were mentioning, there are many problems related to time. And they're all very interesting. One of them is, what is the nature of time in physics, for example, or what is the nature of time in general? Another one is, what is the propositional account? What kind of propositional account of tense can we give in language? That's another very interesting issue. And then there's this problem that I wanted to isolate, which is what I ended up doing in the book, which is, how can any creature that represents time do that? And what are the mechanisms underlying time representation? Are those independent from language or from the language capacity? And is there a way to isolate temporal representation from other representations, for example, the representation of causality or the representation of agency or the self? And so that's how I ended up working on this.
So I've characterized the explanandum of your book as, you know, how do we represent time?
Exactly.
Maybe you want to, I don't know if you want to clarify that a little bit further in terms of its relation to some of the other debates, you know, the more famous maybe debates on the A theory versus the B theory, or presentism versus eternalism.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a very good question, because the way I started the project was I wanted to engage a bit more with the debate in metaphysics. I quickly realized that it was just too ambitious to do that, because the debate in metaphysics, particularly the debate between the A theory, the theory that says that there is an objective there's something objectively unique about the present moment, and so there's always an objectively sensible answer to the question, what moment is present? So there's a theory that says that defends that view, the A theory, and then there's the alternative view, the B theory, that says that's false. There's no objective present, and there's no unique there's sort of no objective passage of time. And then what they say, that this is how I got interested in these debates from the representational side of things. What the B theory says is that the passage of time is an illusion. And of course, illusions are the realm, they fall within the domain of analysis of psychology. And it's interesting that within this metaphysical debate, all of a sudden this psychological claim gets made and becomes central, right? So I wanted to understand, even if it's an illusion, I mean, regardless of what happens in terms of the physical reality of time, we need an account of, even if it's illusory, even if it's not entirely carving nature at its joints, as people say, there must be an explanation of how we represent time, and that's how this fits a little bit within that debate. Although, of course, I don't end up saying anything particular about metaphysics, but that's how it fits within the broader debate.
So your account is consistent with us being, you know, all of our beliefs about time being completely false, but that's just not, you know, that's not relevant to your concerns.
Well, I think so one aspect of the problem is that you need to have certain constraints to represent time, and those constraints cannot just be merely sort of subjective dispositional constraints. And I try to explain in the book that there must be some objective basis for time representation. But you're right that it is compatible with what the B theorist says, because the B theorist wants truth makers for propositions about simultaneity or succession, for example. Mm-hmm. And they believe that there are such relations of succession and simultaneity. They just deny that there is this objective passage of time. And all I need to give an account of the objective basis for the representation of time are those relations. I mean, I do end up saying something that is a bit controversial, which is that these relations of succession of simultaneity are not something we really experience when we have the phenomenology of time. But a lot of this information processing happens unconsciously. And there's a ton of time keepers that are not even representational. So, but yeah, to answer your question, that's how I think it's what I say in the book is in principle compatible with the two major views on the nature of time, the A theory and the B theory. I think that doesn't really. I mean, so for example, if all propositions regarding the passage of time are false, that is a bit of orthogonal to what I do in the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at the very end, I saw a nice. You write that what one needs to successfully and reliably represent time are clocks and simultaneity judgments, and that was a nice, very simple and precise way of, you know, summing up, you know, basically the work of the book. And so you begin with a discussion of clocks, of timekeepers, mm-hmm. and then you proceed into, you know, questions of the nature of mental representation, and then you proceed at the end to this, to what you call your two-phase model of the present, of how we represent the present. So I think let's start with the clocks. You go
Excellent.
Into, you know, a lot of very interesting detail about the different two different kinds of clocks, two different times of timekeepers, the various advantages and disadvantages, and then of course some that you call semi-hybrid timekeepers. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could say a bit about these different kinds of timekeepers, and then our biological, right, the circadian clock and then the stopwatch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So I think this is what I found the most fascinating about the psychological literature is the depth and detail of the studies that psychologists and biologists have done. It's actually breathtaking. When I started reading, it's just beautiful research, and it's really rich. So in that section of the book, what I try to explain is that the sort of anecdotal evidence that animals were great timekeepers, and in particular bees and insects, and the mere fact that animals navigate imply that they have rich spatiotemporal representation, needed a lot of evidential basis to really become a precise statement concerning time representation and sort of biological mechanisms to keep track of time. But the debate of what exactly constrains a clock, or what is a clock, is actually a debate that started a little bit more in physics. So I talk a lot about Reichenbach, because he, in his book, The Philosophy of Space and Time, explains in a lot of detail and with great clarity that a clock is really just a process, and that's it has to be a physical process. And just like you need, as Einstein realized, rigid rods to measure space, and then certain assumptions about energy and forces and so on, you need units of time to measure time. And those units of time are not ideas, they're not concepts, they are aspects of processes, so aspects of natural processes. So he has this discussion on why the daily cycle of day and night, the rotation of the Earth on its own axis, is actually a great clock, because it has a constant rate, it repeats itself, it's stable, it's reliable, and more importantly, you can divide it into units, and those units have the metric aspects that you need to guarantee reliable measurements of time, namely intervals can be compared, and they are invariant with these comparisons. They are the basis, for example, for additive properties of these measurements. So twice an interval will always be twice an interval because the units are precise, and the rate of the passage of time in the clock is kept constant. So the constraints that you need to guarantee precise time measurement are exactly the same constraints that you need to measure time physically with physical clocks. So those constraints were found in some biological systems. And then actually the circadian clock, which is this clock that Reichenbach talks about as a very reliable clock that guarantees these metric constraints on intervals and other constraints that clocks must satisfy. This clock was found throughout biological organisms, the circadian clock. It was found, obviously, in human beings, and it has a big impact on our sense of time. But one interesting question is, what makes a clock... So once you have a reliable clock, and they have different advantages. So, for example, when you represent time with a circadian clock or a cyclical clock, you lose track of certain things. So you lose track, for example, of when something starts and when something ends, or you need to impose a representation on the clock to do that. Whereas if you have an interval clock, let's say an hourglass, you flip the hourglass, you know exactly which was the beginning moment and which is the last moment, right? So it's empty, the bottom is empty, and all of a sudden the top of the clock is empty, and that indicates the end of the interval. So these advantages of these and disadvantages, when people started designing clocks, for example, the atomic clock that is used in physics, they used the cycles of an atom to mark the pace of a pacemaker, and so it is an incredibly precise clock. So psychologists started asking what exactly happens when we measure time. What are the clocks that we have? And as it turns out, we have two clocks, one cyclical, which is the circadian clock, and it's very precise. It emulates the rotation of the Earth on its own axis. And we have another clock, which works a little bit more like an hourglass. And the experiments show that the representations actually have... So these are not merely mechanical clocks. We don't merely biologically... respond to these clocks, although of course they are part of our biology. We actually have mental representations of time that interface with space and with other magnitudes like rate or density, and these representations are based on on the neural processes that underlie the circadian clock and the stopwatch. So it took a lot of ingenuity and time and research to figure out which animals represent time, why those representations are really representations. They're not merely biological processes. And so, for example, why, although plants have a circadian clock, in an obvious way they cannot represent time, why insects have a circadian clock? And besides using that circadian clock for many biological processes like gene expression, they also use that clock to navigate, which is a deeply representational activity. So I don't know if this answers a little bit what your question. It was a very rich question and very exciting to me, because that's the part of the book where I really realized sort of the gigantic amount of research that had to be done to corroborate these capacities to represent time, and in particular the existence of these two clocks.
Well, I mean, it was a surprise to me that you talked about the stopwatch. I mean, we've all heard about the circadian clock, you know, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, but I had not heard about the stopwatch. And I take it we do not have a, there's no particular structure that is the stopwatch, right? It's just a process, some sort of interval process, right?
Yes, exactly. So the, as you said, the suprachiasmatic nucleus has been confirmed to be the locus of the circadian clock. And it is pretty uncontroversial that it exists. And you're right that the stopwatch is a little bit more controversial, because the models that psychologists have proposed turn out to be a bit naive. So they literally think that the process that the brain instantiates when the brain measures intervals. So what is not controversial is that the brain does two things. It can represent time in a sort of for longer periods, even periods of hours or several hours, in terms of circadian clock representation. So insects can do this. But then for shorter intervals, birds, but also humans, have the capacity to emulate intervals. And this is from seconds to minutes in a very precise way. And they can abstract and add these intervals, clearly having representations of these intervals. And these are this is important because the resolution of the clock is finely tuned to relevant intervals. So, for example, replenishing of flower nectar for birds is one of those intervals. Predicting when the light is going to turn green at a stop is one of those intervals in the case of humans when they drive. Mm-hmm. And so for this type of process, the representation of time is not cyclical. Rather, it is interval-like or linear, but in for very short intervals. And so the models that the famous model proposed by Gibbon was called the pacemaker. And Warren Meck also studied a lot of the neural correlates of this pacemaker, and it is believed that it's deeply related to attention. There's a cortical area that is supposed to be involved in this process. But you're right that it is probably it's misleading to call it a stopwatch, because the image that comes to mind is that the something is ticking inside the brain. As if an hourglass was getting filled. But something like that, something analogous to that, happens in the brain. That's the idea. That is very unlike the circadian clock. And it is important for a lot of behaviors. It's very important for simultaneity judgments, for example, cross simultaneity. And it's also very important for actions that the motor system has to frame in a linear way rather than in a longer sort of temporal frame where the circadian clock could be used.
Okay, so I mean, I'm tempted to ask more about the clocks, but I would like to turn to the nature of temporal representation so that we can get to a lot of the material on simultaneity judgments, because that too was fascinating. So both timekeepers produce representations of time, and somewhat in different ways, right? One is periodic and one is interval. And they both produce them, these representations, for use by the sensory motor system.
Exactly.
Okay. So one thing I guess I wasn't clear about is whether they contribute to a single representation or whether they contribute distinct representations. And then furthermore, just what sort of notion of representation are you using to explain the contents of each of these representations or the one combination representation?
So this is a very, very interesting topic. One of the most the main motivations I had to work on this issue, the representation of time, is that time representation seems to be really, really unique. Because it doesn't involve the typical symbolic representation. So one thing that I say in the book is that representations of time are approximate; they are analog, if in a sort of philosophical sense of analog, which means that they are dense, and you can always be more precise, ever more precise. Or change the scale and lose precision to gain generality and so on. So, in that sense, both clocks produce the same type of representation in the sense that they are analog, approximate. They are not exclusively symbolic. If they are interfaced with symbolic representations, that is not what underlies, for example, navigation. So what underlies navigation is this more approximate analog way of representing time. But there's a sense in which the representations differ really importantly. And the way, for example, psychologists like Galistel explain it is that the mathematical way of understanding the structure of the representation of the circadian clock is in terms of the angles of a circle. So that's one of the explanations of how insects navigate. They use the solar ephemeris function and the angle of the sun to compute location. So they literally translate readings of the cycle of the circadian clock into spatiotemporal locations that they use for sun compass navigation. And so this is clearly a representational process, right? And one of the questions is, why is this not just a mere response to light, for example, mm-hmm. or the cycle of the sun? And the answer I give in the book is that it cannot be just that kind of sort of biological-based reaction, because computing the solar ephemeris function based on the circadian clock really requires several representations that need to be cognitively integrated in terms of a common cause. It obviously is not a propositional language that the insect is using, or the insect is not really deducing conclusions from premises. Rather, what the insect is doing, according to this research, is mapping different representations. One of them is the circadian clock reading with positions that the insect needs to locate itself in a map. And so this process uses several representations. It cognitively integrates these representations, and that means that the insect is capable of representing time in terms of its circadian clock. Unlike that representation, the representation of produced by the stopwatch, for example, the representation of time produced by the stopwatch is not really model. I mean, if you want to express it mathematically, you really don't need this angle-based representation of the, for example, the degrees of a circle, but rather the structure of the line in mathematics. And interestingly, Kant and Schopenhauer and other philosophers had this view that the origin of the mathematical continuum, the real numbers, is a representation of time, right? And so this very much goes along with that idea. So the idea is the interval clock produces a representation of time that is linear. It has this inverse correlation with respect to the specificity of the measurement. So if it's a very short interval clock, it is very precise with respect to that short interval, but then it loses resolution as the intervals increase. But the idea is there is no limit with respect to how long or small the interval is in principle, right? I mean, there are biological limits, but in terms of the representation, the time is represented approximately, and in terms of segments of a line, and so you can express that in terms of numbers in the real line. And of course, that doesn't mean that we literally represent intervals in terms of real numbers. What it means is that that's one way of expressing the structure mm-hmm. of the representation produced by the stopwatch, just like the circle and the mathematical relations among the angles of a circle express the structure of the representation of the representations of time produced by the circadian clock.
So what we've been using the term representation, obviously quite a bit. So maybe you can say something about the notion of representation, or mental representation, I suppose.
Yeah.
That you defend in the book. It's more or less, I take it, a standard sort of teleoinformational account. So maybe you could say a word about the nature of these representations in the mental representational sense, how they get their content and how we know they misrepresent.
Yes, I mean that's a great question. It's a tricky question because the teleological notion of a representation. So that is, for example, Millikan's idea that the representation. Anything that has any process that has a structure in which ends are interrelated with means in the behavior of a creature shows that there's some representational content that you can express in terms of the teleological function. Namely, there is a goal that the creature wants to achieve, and a condition for the creature to succeed is some sort of content that the creature is representing. That turns out to be a tricky notion because plants do this, right? So,
right.
And I, plants have a function that they fulfill. For example, they have some form of procedures by means of which they equilibrate themselves and control water absorption, solar energy absorption, and so on. These are all goals that the plant meets by satisfying certain constraints. They're all objective environmental constraints depending on the position of the sun and the position of the plant and so on. And it seems to use the clock, right? It seems plants heavily use the circadian clock to do these things. So you look at a sunflower, the sunflower it turns and follows the sun, yeah. Keeps track of the sun. And so then the question is, well, that conception of representation seems to prove too much or seems to be inadequate, but that because now we're attributing representations to plants. And so I have a way of avoiding that problem. But did you want to say something?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think that is definitely a problem because then you get into further problems like when you see the trunk of a tree, it seems to be keeping track of the years, right?
Right,
with the tree rings. But obviously, the tree is not representing time in a sort of very, very obvious way. So what I say is they're not even these processes that the plants are going through or they're performing are clearly not even representational. They are encoding information. But in order to, and actually Millikan says a little bit about this, in order for that process, a teleological process, to count as a representational process, the information needs to be used in a way, right? Mm-hmm. So it needs a user or an agent that reads the information, and then that becomes a representation. So tree trunks are not representations that the tree uses. They are representations that humans use to keep track of years. And so that has to happen with the clocks. Just merely responding to environmental features automatically and causally is not enough to give you a representational relation. You need a way to use that information. So, for example, insects use that information to navigate and to compute information for sun compass navigation. Birds use information from their stopwatch to compute rates of nectar refilling in flowers. And so that's how you get rid of this objection that it's too weak. The theological representation account is too weak to explain time clock representation. Now, there's a further problem that, for example, Tyler Birch talks about, that even if you have representational processes, if they are too isolated or too subpersonal, they may not count as representations because, for example, they may be too close to the proximal stimuli. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about the retina, are the encodings that happen in the visual cortex representations? Well, they are. If you think that anything that maps information in a systematic way and tracks information from the environment is a representation, then those mappings count as a representation. Mm-hmm. So a way of avoiding that problem, which is different from the automatic response to the environment problem, is to have this further constraint that I say the representations of the clock definitely satisfy, which is that the representer, the user of the representation, or the mental cognitive agent, mm-hmm. in this case, insects or humans or birds or whatever, need to use this representation at the personal level, not just at a very isolated level of information processing, mm-hmm. but in a way that deeply informs their behavior, right? And also in a way in which environmental particulars are represented as such. So intervals of time are represented as intervals of time. And not only that, they can be attributed to a particular event, right? Mm-hmm. And research shows that insects, birds, and other creatures can do this.
Okay, so once we have sort of a notion of, you know, timekeeping and then representation, you sort of pull it all together in another, you know, very interesting discussion of simultaneity judgments across a number of different sense modalities, and then, you know, how these come together in a multimodal sensory or simultaneity window. And so you end up with what you call a two-phase model of the present. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to kind of, you know, go through the different parts of that because, you know, each of the parts was pretty interesting. And I think maybe we can start with some of the modality specific simultaneity windows or that, you know, that we have the judgments we have about, you know, when we've just, you know, seen one thing as opposed to seen two things, or heard one thing as opposed to heard two things.
Yes, definitely. So this is another area of research, all of which is based on human subjects, obviously. I mean, this is research on sense-specific simultaneity windows. And what, I mean, the really interesting, so there's two aspects of this research that makes it particularly fascinating. So going back to the constraints on precise time measurements, these are just physical constraints, right? That physicists use all the time to measure time or the time of certain events. You need the constancy, the unit of time constraints, so units must be all the same to have reliable time measurements. The rate at which time passes needs to be constant because then that's a requirement for the units to be the same length. But then a further constraint is how do you know that given to different events, whether or not they happen at the same time, right? That's a deeply different question from just keeping track of time based on units of time, because this question requires you to have a way of knowing whether or not two distant events in space are happening at the same time. So in a way, you kind of need either two clocks or some sort of judgment to determine that. And what is interesting about what Reichenbach says about this is that that judgment, just like the decision that something is the right unit for time, is a bit arbitrary, right? Mm-hmm. So it just needs to satisfy the right constraints. It needs to give you precise measurements. They can never be more precise. You can always be more precise, and so on. That means there's no definitive standards. But you need these to have, obviously, time measurements, right? So and animals and humans need this as well. So you need, in order to comprehend what someone is saying, you need to know what sounds are simultaneous with the words that are coming from someone's mouth. To play tennis, you need to know when a ball is hitting and whether or not the body is hitting at the same time that you're moving your arm, and so on and so on. So this is a different problem, and the brain cannot use, and this is what is super interesting, the brain cannot just use the clocks to solve this problem, right? Mm-hmm. Because the clocks are just ticking. They are very useful, but they cannot by themselves tell the brain whether two events are happening at the same time. Now, what complicates things is that the events that are happening outside the brain are coming into the brain through different sense signals, and these signals are coming at different speeds.
Right.
So light is coming at a very, very, very fast speed, and sound is not coming at such fast speed, and the proprioceptive system has different thresholds and so on. So the trick that the brain evolves to solve this problem is it has different thresholds for simultaneity. So the threshold for simultaneity in audition is very, very small compared to that of vision. Maybe that's because of the speeds of light and sound. And so in the auditory modality, very quickly you know that two events are not simultaneous because the simultaneity window is very, very small. I think it's 2 milliseconds. And that changes in vision, and that changes in the haptic modality. And so this creates a problem, right? Because if two events could be simultaneous in the auditory modality, but not simultaneous in the visual modality, and that's because the windows are different. The window for simultaneity in vision is larger than the window for simultaneity in audition. Then how does the brain compensate for these discrepancies, right?
Right.
And so that's where I start proposing that there has to be a cross-model window for sensory simultaneity that smoothens out these discrepancies. Otherwise, it would be very difficult to operate, right? You would have simultaneity judgments from audition telling you this is simultaneous, but what you're seeing is not simultaneous, and we would operate in pretty schizophrenic ways, time-wise, right?
Right.
So the bigger window, the cross-model window, is not only bigger in the sense that it smoothens out discrepancies between audition and vision and the haptic modality. It's also crucial to have a overall judgment of what is simultaneous, period. And this happens unconsciously. That's what I say in the book. We don't really quite experience this. It's a decision that is made for us in a way that is similar to syntax processing. So if you think about syntax processing, you're not really aware of how is it that you're parsing the information that you encode syntactically when you speak a language. Of course, there are aspects of language that you're conscious of. You're aware of the meaning of a word or the imagery that a word evokes. Mm-hmm. But you're not really conscious of the syntax processing that underlies language, the language capacity. You're not even conscious of the articulatory code that depends on that syntax processing. So something like that happens with this simultaneous judgment. And so that's the first component. This cross-model window is the first component of this proposal that I make in the book of the two-phase model of the present. So let me stop here and see if you have questions about this first.
Yeah. So at this point, we're talking about the what you call the sensorial present.
Exactly.
So maybe just to step back a little bit and then roll forward. Philosophers will discuss, you know, the specious present, you know, the briefest moment that we can experience, you know, succession or change, and they'll ask about the relationship between this specious present, you know, what we're experiencing, and the indexical now.
Yeah.
Right, or something, or they'll talk about the unity of consciousness and, you know, the present, you know, what is now present to me in my consciousness. And so, on your view, this is kind of confused because it's mushing together two distinct presents that we actually represent, or that we well, I don't want to use the word experience because one of them is not, at least not always experienced. I suppose it can be, but it isn't typically. Just as we don't typically experience, or we're not typically conscious of processing syntax, but you can interrupt things and then suddenly make that, you know, But so it's not necessarily unconscious, mm-hmm. But it for the most part it is. So you've got this sensorial present that we've sort of been talking about, and then you've got this the phenomenal present, and their traditional, you know, discussions of the specious present have sort of mushed these things together, and you're trying to distinguish them. So maybe we can, you know, to go back to where we were with the specious present, the sensorial present as the representation of this multi-sensory integration window, you know, simultaneity window.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one sense, right? There's a representation there, and that's for sensory motor coordination.
Exactly.
And then there's the other one, which is what you call the phenomenal present.
Yes.
So maybe you could say, so the question I wanted, before we get to the phenomenal present, first I wanted to ask, we were talking about this integrated multimodal window that sort of encompasses all the different simultaneity windows of the distinct sense modalities. And one of the things that you said there that I thought was really interesting was, it's not just that this sensorial present, this multimodal integration window, somehow integrates all the different senses despite their different simultaneity windows, but also that there's an ordering that goes on that gets imposed on these, you know, because you've got different simultaneities. And that, of course, means that things are going to be presented in a different order. And so maybe you could say something about what happens, you know, to get all these simultaneity windows to integrate and get an order. And then also why the mechanism that orders them is itself, you know, is sort of not a temporal mechanism.
Yeah, so... The reason why I think it's bad, and that's, you're right that I say in the book that it's there's a bit of ambiguity in the literature when they talk about the sensorial, the specious present, And I think that ambiguity should be avoided, because the species present involves these two radically different cognitive processes. One of them involves conscious experience. The other one involves sensory motor representation of time for coordination. A very clear way to see that is that the constraints that any measurement of time needs to satisfy to count as a good time measurement are all satisfied by the sensorial present, right? So it satisfies the units of time constraint and the uniformity of rate constraint by having good clocks, the circadian clock and the stopwatch. What is a good clock? Is a clock that satisfies those constraints, right? So it also satisfies the simultaneity constraint by having good mechanisms to detect these the synchrony of events by means of these windows that the brain has, right? And so a good way to think of these windows is as a hierarchy of smaller windows that get integrated into the sensorial present. But then once you have the judgment that two events are simultaneous, you need the clocks to know whether, once you know that something is simultaneous, that is also simultaneous with another event, or if time has passed between that event and another event. So you need not only simultaneity judgments, but also a way to represent duration, mm-hmm. right? In most debates on the species present, this is never even mentioned. Mm-hmm. But it is absolutely fundamental to navigate. And I think what happens, or at least this is why I think the sensorial present is part of it is a component of this model that I call the two-phase model. But it's also good to think of it as part of the measurements that we need to navigate and coordinate time. So it gives the crucial information that two events are simultaneous. But then, in order for you to really operate in time, you not only need these simultaneity judgments, but as you were saying, you need to order them in terms of duration. And the only reliable way of doing that is by interfacing the clock with the simultaneity judgments from the cross-model window to the clock, such that the moments, the intervals of time, somehow correlate with the simultaneity chunks of milliseconds. Let's say they're smaller than 250 milliseconds. Those chunks, mm-hmm. in which everything is simultaneous, right?
Yeah.
Anything below that window, the brain is going to register as simultaneous. Those chunks are going to correlate with the intervals of time that the clocks are going to measure. Mm-hmm. So that imposes an ordering automatically in the sensory motor system, because you have a good clock that is getting information from this systematic computation of simultaneity. And so that ordering, I say, is also an ordering that occurs without our being aware of it. It doesn't really involve conscious experiences. Mm-hmm. What it really involves is representations from the clocks, mm-hmm. and they need to be representations, as we mentioned before, not just biological processes or even cortical mappings. And they also need to overlap with simultaneity judgments. And so that gets all done unconsciously with the systems to compute simultaneity, and also with the clocks to give this very rich, as I say in the book, it's a very rich space of possible actions. It gives you a configuration space of action, because you know how to react to stimuli, how to embed information temporally, and so on. And so I think that needs to be clearly distinguished, because when people talk about the species present, they say, oh, it's the smallest. The one idea is the smallest amount of time in which something is present, mm-hmm. but is not point-like, right? It's not the Planck scale, and it's not a millisecond. So that's specious, right? Because it's not point-like. Well, in that sense of specious, this sensorial present is specious because it's not point-like. It's not instantaneous. Mm-hmm. It is a few milliseconds, right? But in a different sense, it's not the specious present that many philosophers have in mind, because they then start talking about experiences. So then they say the specious present is the shortest amount of time in which you experience a musical phrase. Well, that's clearly not related to these much more precise simultaneity judgments that the sensory motor system makes, right? And so I think that ambiguity is best kept sort of... it's much better if we disambiguate this term, because then we can know what we're talking about when we say something is present, right?
So it's kind of like when people talk about the B theory in metaphysics and then introduce the notion of illusion, right? That we started with. Well, illusion is a mental notion, and so you're sort of off and running into a different direction.
Exactly.
And the same thing here with experience. It seems like when people start if philosophers start talking about the present in terms of a moment, you know, a temporal notion of some sort, and then say that we experience, mm-hmm. for you, of course, that's already bringing in something else that isn't part of what explains the present as we judge, you know, sort of subconsciously.
Exactly. And if I could add something, you're completely right. And something that is important is for the brain to satisfy the all these constraints, sort of the simultaneity judgment constraint and the other, the passage of time constraint in terms of the rate and units of time constraint, the brain doesn't need experiences to do this, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it would be odd if the brain needed experiences to do this, because what the brain needs is reliable timekeepers, mm-hmm. representations based on those timekeepers, and judgments in order to determine whether or not two events happen simultaneously. And that really has nothing to do with what the subject is experiencing. It has to do with satisfying this objective constraint. So it makes sense that the brain has these mechanisms operating in a very, very motor-like way, sort of like the way we process syntax, because otherwise it would be difficult to satisfy them if we had to have awareness in the mix. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not that awareness is irrelevant. Of course, awareness of time is a very, very deeply problematic issue, but it is irrelevant to satisfy these constraints.
Well, maybe we should talk about the phenomenal present, because that is where experience is critical. So maybe you can say a word about that and then how these two are related to each other.
Yeah. The term two-phase model, I came up with that term for lack of a better term, but the idea is that these simultaneity windows clearly are not operating on experiences, right? Mm-hmm. The domain or the range of application of these windows is mostly signals from the sense modalities. It cannot be the experience of smelling a flower or the experience of listening to a Beethoven symphony. Okay. So what is that, right? That's where the original motivation to talk about the specious present came from, and at least if you read William James. But of course, these examples of listening to a musical phrase or the experience of having anxiety and so on, these are typically rich examples that Husserl used and many other phenomenologists like Merleau-Ponty. So what is that? I think we don't have a good theory of what that is. But what I say is that it has to be something radically different from the sensorial present, That's why I call it a two-phase model, because if simultaneity information is used at all in the generation of this phenomenal present, it has to be used in a radically different way, sort of the way a phase transition happens, right? So the transition that water undergoes from solid to liquid is that kind of transition. So there's a deep modification of the information, and the information is no longer structured in terms of simultaneity, judgment, and duration. It is rather information that integrates in a very, very unique way, sort of amalgamates different experiences into this very, very thick present moment, right? And so that's exactly the term, for example, Nick Humphrey uses to talk about this. He calls it the thick time of experience. And the reason why it's thick is because simultaneity and duration are completely relevant for this type of integration. What matters for this type of integration, and I think Tim Bain and Dave Chalmers call this subsumption, the relation responsible for this type of integration, is that in the phenomenal present, all experiences are integrated into an overall experience, which people also call a total experience. And in this total experience, there is the sense that all your experiences are present to you at once. But of course, this notion of present to you is not really the notion of are simultaneously encoded. Because this notion of presence, which is a lot more elusive than the notion of simultaneity, involves the presence of anxiety plus the presence of the melody of a song plus the presence of your proprioceptive experience of how your body is located, and so on and so on and so on. And, so that's why I think that one thing I say is we don't have a good account of that. But it's clearly different. One thing we can say safely about that kind of integration is that it is not really the type of integration that happens for simultaneity, and that's what I call the sensorial present.
So just to pursue this a little bit further. So the phenomenal, but you do say that the phenomenal present involves the experience of succession or of a passage of time, and not just a succession of appearances, but actually an experience of succession of time. I thought maybe you could say something about that. And you also say, you do draw some important distinctions, I think, between these two types of representations of the present, in terms of the information, the sources, I think, of information that they integrate,
exactly.
And the metric constraint. One, the phenomenal present does not have the metric constraint. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Yes, definitely. I would like to start with a metric constraint because it's a bit less tricky. So if you think about the metric constraints as the constraints on any time measurement, including time measurements in physics, those are satisfied by the sensorial present, right? The simultaneity windows plus the clocks. Now, if you think about how your current experience is integrated, right? Your experience of listening to me, feeling what you're feeling, the expectations that you're having, the thoughts that you're having, and so on, the imagery associated with those thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. Those don't seem to depend on those metric constraints, right? So they don't seem to, the integration of those experiences, even though you feel they're passing in time, they don't seem to be fully integrated based on whether they're simultaneous or not, or whether they are happening at the same time, strictly speaking, in terms of which window is operating and so on. So it's not only that the integration seems to be metrically unconstrained, or at least not metrically, not reduced to the metric constraints of typical time measurements, but you're right. Also, one thing that is important to emphasize that I say at the end of the book is that the sources of information for phenomenal integration are a lot larger than the what the sensorial present does in terms of detecting signals, right? So you have that kind of integration in dreams. So when you're dreaming, your experiences are being integrated phenomenally. You're having visual experiences, you're experiencing color, you're experiencing emotions, but your sensory motor system is turned off, right? You're just lying in bed. So that kind of that's what I mean by metrically unconstrained. They seem to be different in terms of the constraints that these processes for integrating experiences are trying to satisfy. So I think that is a bit clearer than the issue, which is a lot more tricky. But I'm glad you brought it up, of the difference between a succession of experiences. Now, notice that we're talking about experiences, right? It's not just a succession of events or a succession of signals that the brain is detecting, but a succession of experiences. The difference between that, the succession of experiences, and the experience of succession, right? I think that is a very, very tricky issue. I say very sort of tentative things about that. What I think is safe to say is that it is true that when you talk about how we experience the passage of time, not just measure the passage of time with the clocks, but experience it, that experience cannot be captured in terms of many, many experiences having at different times an order in terms of simultaneous relations, right? Sort of as in the way a movie frames of pictures create the illusion that something is moving, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the experience of passage, because of certain experiences, like the experience of anxiety or the experience of or emotions in general, cannot be just reduced to successions, right? There's something unique about the experience of succession. And that's where I say that sort of aspect of our experience of the passage of time favors certain views that get called in the literature on temporal consciousness as the extensional model. And the extensional model, what one aspect of the extensional model, there's several different things about it, but one aspect of it is this claim that experiencing the passage of time cannot be reduced to vignettes of successive experiences.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about time for over an hour, so I think actually we are running out of time. So let me just, there's a lot more to discuss, but, this is an interval, and
yeah.
So the interval is coming to its natural conclusion. And the natural conclusion here is just, do you have, a follow-up project on this, or what are you working on next? Is there something completely different, or are you going to follow this up with other research related?
Yes, I actually am very interested in this issue that you mentioned, that it is fascinating that B-theorists, part of their claim, or of actually not part, a very central claim they make is that the passage of time is an illusion. So I'm very interested in trying to really try to get a grip on that claim. What exactly do they mean, and how to account for that illusion, and sort of keep exploring this issue of what kind of relation you need to integrate experiences and how it's independent from the metric of the sensorial present. So I'm working now on the sort of on that kind of one project involves the illusion of passage. I'm also very interested in just conscious awareness in general, and this type of relation that integrates experiences into a phenomenal whole that I think is not only gaining momentum as an important philosophical topic, but psychologists are also very interested in this, and I'm very interested in it too.
Well, great. So, thank you very much. And,
no, thank you, Carrie. This was great.
Great talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Carlos Montemayor about his new book, Minding Time, A Philosophical and Theoretical Approach to the Psychology of Time, just out from Brill. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.